Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Internist's Guide 2, a limited series dedicated to high-yield guidelines in internal medicine.
In this episode, I speak to Dr. Andrew Ha from Cardiology on the CCS-CHRS Comprehensive Guidelines for the Management of Atrial Fibrillation, released in 2020. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Andrew Ha, a cardiac electrophysiologist at the University Health Network. Dr. Ha's interests and clinical focus is in atrial fibrillation. Welcome to the show, Dr. Ha.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
So I'm going to start by asking if you could tell us a little bit about how atrial fibrillation ties into your clinical practice.
Great, thanks. So I'm a heart rhythm specialist and electrophysiologist. The bread and butter of EP, electrophysiology EP, is atrial fibrillation. We're involved in basically all aspects of managing these patients. Specifically, we get involved in difficult to manage AFib cases and also giving advice on anticoagulation, especially the challenging ones. And thirdly, patients who need invasive management, such as ablation when they have symptomatic AF. So those are the areas that electrophysiologists get involved.
So Dr. Ha, I just want to ask you a little bit about rate versus rhythm control. So thinking about the CCS guidelines 2020 for atrial fibrillation, when is rate versus rhythm control recommended?
Okay, thanks. I think the first decision point from an internist perspective is to decide whether this is stable versus, you know, unstable AFib. So if it's hemodynamically unstable, acute atrial fibrillation, the right thing to do is an urgent cardioversion, electrically most likely. If someone has atrial fibrillation and it's hemodynamically stable, and you see this patient, let's say in a clinical, like in an outpatient clinic, a lot of it is driven by the type of atrial fibrillation a patient has. Is the patient having paroxysmal atrial fibrillation or persistent atrial fibrillation? So if someone has paroxysmal AFib, meaning that he or she has atrial fibrillation, you know, a few hours a week, few hours a day, several times a week, then you assess in your mind and talking to the patient how symptomatic the patient is. Is there a lot of AFib to a point where the patient is really bothered and affected in terms of his or her energy levels, quality of life? Or it's fairly low burden in terms of, you know, it happens once every 6 months, let's say. If someone has a low burden atrial fibrillation in terms of very, very infrequent and not really that symptomatic, you know, it's not wrong to just simply observe, because sometimes the drugs in of themselves can cause side effects. Let's say the patient doesn't have a lot of atrial fibrillation, but these episodes are symptomatic, for instance, a few times a year. One option to pursue is the so-called pill in a pocket approach, where you prescribe a type 1C antiarrhythmic drug in addition with an AV node blocker to be used on a PRN basis. Personally speaking, I find this approach useful if someone only has a couple of AF episodes a year. It's probably not as pragmatic if someone is having weekly episodes of AF and are using these drugs on a PRN basis on a fairly frequent basis. If that's the case, they probably should be on daily medication use. So that's for patients of low recurrence burden. For patients of a high recurrence burden, so in other words, multiple episodes of AF, long AF episodes, or very symptomatic from the atrial fibrillation, I think that approach, we would use an antiarrhythmic drug, because these patients are symptomatic from the AF, and clearly restoration and maintenance of sinus rhythm will be beneficial for them. So in those patients with high burden atrial fibrillation and clearly being in sinus rhythm is way better, we would prescribe them with, you know, antiarrhythmic drugs on a daily basis. The other option is an ablation. Typically speaking, ablation is reserved for patients in whom antiarrhythmic drugs are ineffective, not tolerated, or not preferred. One example will be athletes or people who are young and very active who don't want to be on drugs on a long-term basis. Let's switch to the other type of atrial fibrillation. So these are patients with persistence, long-standing persistence, or permanent atrial fibrillation. So these are patients with atrial fibrillation on a continuous basis, 24/7, 365, sometimes for months, sometimes for years. So the first line approach for these patients with chronic, ongoing, continuous AF will be rate control. So an AV node blocker, beta blocker, non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, or digoxin. Often you need more than one rate control agents to result in good rate control for the patients. To optimize rate control, which I think we'll get into on a subsequent question, it's mainly symptom-based. typically speaking, you want to keep the rate below 100 beats per minute, and also to make sure that the patient has less symptoms because they're not tachycardic. If, let's say, rate control is inadequate, then you would proceed with rhythm control. And the first step we will use is a cardioversion. So you can refer them for an electrical cardioversion or load them with an antiarrhythmic drug, then refer for electrical cardioversion. This is to see if restoration and maintenance of sinus rhythm would improve their energy levels, quality of life, and AF-related symptoms. The other so let's say you have a patient with persistent AF and you initiate rate control and it doesn't work. As I said, we'll go to cardioversion. If cardioversion doesn't work, or if it worked, but then it only lasted a couple of weeks and it comes back, then we'll have a real discussion with the patient on either long-term antiarrhythmic drug use or ablation at that point.
Great, thank you. And I know you already alluded to the fact that with thinking about rate control, we will focus on targeting symptom management and symptom burden. When might you implement a target heart rate, or would you use a target heart rate as your method of assessment as to whether you've achieved your goal with managing with rate control?
Thanks. I think it's a very popular topic we get referred on is, you know, what is the optimal rate control? Based on clinical trials, you know, there was a trial which randomized patients to either a strict or lenient rate control. So strict control being less than 80 beats per minute, lenient being less than 110 beats per minute. And what they found published in the New England Journal of Medicine was that there was no difference with respect to heart outcomes like stroke, heart failure, and mortality between a lenient and a strict program. The biggest thing now, you know, when we try to achieve rate control is twofold. One is to make sure that the patient is less symptomatic. And second is to prevent tachycardia-mediated cardiomyopathy. So those are the two key aspects of rate control. When you look at the guidelines, typically speaking, the desired target rate is less than 100 beats per minute at rest. Certainly, it depends on symptoms and also presence of left ventricular dysfunction. If the patient is still symptomatic in spite of having a rate of 90, we might go up on the rate control agent in terms of dose, or add a second agent to try to see if we can get better rate control and hopefully improve symptoms. If, let's say, we see that the left ventricular systolic function is impaired, and we suspect that this is related to tachycardia from atrial fibrillation, we would also be more aggressive with treating it with a lower rate at that time.
Great, thank you. And you sort of spoke already to chemical cardioversion, or when we're thinking about antiarrhythmic drugs, but I'm wondering a little bit more about electrical cardioversion. You mentioned its importance in the setting of an emergency setting where the patient may have hemodynamically unstable atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there are other circumstances where you might be thinking about electrical cardioversion. So I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit to that.
Perfect. I think when I was training, you know, there's a shifting sands in terms of the field of rhythm control. I think probably in 10, 15 years, rhythm control will be first line. Now traditionally it's still a rate control strategy because of the AFFIRM trial published in 2002 showing that a strategy of rate control is no different than rhythm control medically in terms of heart outcomes like stroke, heart failure, mortality. Recently with the AFNet East 4 trial, it showed that there is actually a slight benefit in favor of rhythm control for recent detected AF less than 1 year. Like new onsets in terms of less stroke and less of these heart outcomes. So it's shifting sands in terms of being more aggressive. And I think we're seeing more and more of it. Patients are actually more receptive toward a more aggressive rhythm control strategy. So, you know, so electrical cardioversion is one method of rhythm control. It is indicated for patients with ongoing AF. So someone with paroxysmal AF, we would not be offering because they're in and out of AFib. So if someone is in continuous atrial fibrillation and you feel clinically that restoration and maintenance of sinus rhythm would be beneficial, then cardioversion would be indicated. So that's a judgment call, and you get a sense based on symptoms. You know, if patients clearly describe, you know, 2 months ago, they started feeling more short of breath, less energetic, and that coincides with the progression from a paroxysmal to persistent. I think that's a very good clue that the ongoing AF is contributing to their impaired quality of life. The other situation we would strongly consider getting them into back to sinus rhythm is AF patients with LV dysfunction, because often if we're able to get them back into sinus rhythm, there's a good chance that their left ventricular systolic function would improve because of being in sinus rhythm and because they're less tachycardic. So basically, cardioversion is indicated for patients with continuous AF and in whom restoration and maintenance of sinus rhythm would, in your opinion, improve the symptoms or improve their heart function in terms of the LVEF. So in terms of chemical versus electrical, I think either approach is good. Often, you know, at least in Canada, I think the first line option is electrical cardioversion. Chemical cardioversion takes time, and you know it involves administration of a drug which some practitioners don't feel comfortable committing that patient to. Often, actually, is a hybrid. So we would actually pre-treat these patients with an antiarrhythmic drug and then refer them for a cardioversion. So if they convert in the interim, great. But if they don't, then at least they would have been pre-treated because there's some good evidence from RCTs showing that if you pre-treat patients, let's say with amiodarone, it would markedly enhance the chance of success in terms of cardioversion acutely and also preventing them from going back into atrial fibrillation.
Great, thank you. So you already sort of touched on the pill and pocket approach, and the 2020 guidelines discuss requirements to fall within a category where you may be amenable to getting pill and pocket therapy, and also discuss contraindications and monitoring for those who are using a pill and pocket approach. When is this used, and what are some of the contraindications, or how might we assess a patient's response to this?
Sure. So the pill in the pocket approach is a good strategy for patients with symptomatic AF, which are happening infrequently, perhaps a few times a year. If someone is getting AFib, you know, once a month or two, three times a month, I wouldn't recommend that strategy because it's just not practical. And we tend to offer this strategy for patients who are healthy generally and have a structurally normal heart. So the way it's prescribed is we prescribe an AV node blocker, either a calcium channel blocker or a beta blocker. Take it, wait 30 minutes, and then the patient will self-administer a type 1C antiarrhythmic drug, either flecainide 300 milligrams or propafenone 600 milligrams. And then because there's some RCT showing that this approach can shorten the time of atrial fibrillation. Contraindications of this drug are, these type 1C antiarrhythmic drugs are considered contraindicated for patients with coronary disease. So if anyone with previous MI or presence of coronary disease, these types of drugs should be avoided because of the risk of proarrhythmia. In the other patient population we would like to avoid are patients with structural heart disease, because these drugs tend to be better for patients with normal hearts. If you have cardiomyopathy, LV dysfunction, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, there may be an increased risk of proarrhythmia. The first time we administer the pill in the pocket, we often ask patients to have it done in a monitored setting. So often we would draft a letter so they would bring to the emergency room saying that, hey, I'm prescribed this medication and for the first time, I would like, you know, this needs to be done in a monitored setting. Because in some instances, these drugs can result in significant bradycardia and or hypotension, which requires monitoring and resuscitation if necessary. So you don't want the patient to be using this medication for the first time while they're traveling in a foreign country. So you want to make sure that it's being done in a monitor setting to prove that it is safe in terms of no hypotension, no proarrhythmia, and no bradycardia. As the first time. So that's generally the framework for using these drugs.
That's helpful. And I remember reading for some of the classes of antiarrhythmics that a long QT might contraindicate use. Is that
the case? Yeah. I think, to be honest, using one dose of the drug, may not, unless someone has a known history of torsade to point or a significantly elevated QT interval, 500 plus, if they're already on multiple QT prolonging drugs, we wouldn't prescribe this drug. If it's not too markedly prolonged, like less than 500 milliseconds, using it as a one-time deal is okay, I think. Obviously, those are special considerations. Typically speaking, if someone has long QT, they probably have structural heart disease. So these drugs we wouldn't prescribe. If someone has isolated long QT syndrome, you know, suggestive of inherited arrhythmia syndrome, let's say, you know, we probably should avoid these drugs as well.
That makes sense. And if someone is on a pill and pocket approach, is there ongoing monitoring that they need, like in terms of blood work or things after they take the medications, or is it really just that monitoring in that, in the first administration that you mentioned?
Yeah. Just the monitoring during the AFib and the conversion, if there is one, because of the fact that it's only a one-time deal and these drugs have short half-lives, usually we don't ask them to be monitored with ongoing ECGs or any blood work going forward.
Thanks. So talking a little bit about cardioversion, there is an algorithm in the new CCS 2020 guidelines on management of acute atrial fibrillation. Let's say you're in an emergency department setting. Can you outline for the listeners what the high yield points from this algorithm are?
Thanks. You know, in the CCS 2020 guidelines, you know, especially on the section on cardioversion, you know, it is still the thing to do when someone has hemodynamically unstable atrial fibrillation or flutter. So we treat atrial fibrillation and flutter the same with respect to the acute treatments. So definitely if someone is unstable, you need to cardiovert them electrically. If the thing that's kind of a new information to the guidelines pertain to anticoagulation, because there were some recent studies from, it's called a FIN-CV trial. So basically this is a series of papers published in Finland in which they have large cohorts of patients who underwent cardioversion and they tracked the outcomes. Most of these studies were retrospective in nature, but they're a large size and it's the best data out there. So it's being used in informing the guidelines. So there are guidelines, they're good data, but there's some limitations given the retrospective nature of how it was collected. So based from these findings, the CCS guidelines made some recommendations on anticoagulation around the time of cardioversion for acute atrial fibrillation or flutter. And it's the two factors to consider is the duration of the arrhythmia by the time you see them, and also the risk factors for stroke. You know, traditionally we take the 48-hour rule, right? Like if someone has atrial fibrillation, acute atrial fibrillation or flutter less than 48 hours, it is quote unquote safe and reasonable to cardiovert them without ruling out left atrial clot, without anticoagulating. Whereas if someone had, you know, 67 hours of atrial fibrillation, then we shouldn't be cardioverting them because of a higher risk of stroke. So, you know, with the new guidelines, there's a bit of a shift with respect to that 40-hour cutoff, and it depends on the patient's risk factors. So if someone has hemodynamically unstable acute atrial fibrillation or flutter, definitely you need to cardiovert them irrespective of whether they're anticoagulated or not. The next one is if they have new onset atrial fibrillation less than 12 hours and no recent stroke or TIA, then you can cardiovert them and initiate OAC afterwards. The third scenario is if they have atrial fibrillation lasting anywhere from 12 to 48 hours and have a low CHAD score being 0 to 1, you can cardiovert them without ruling out left atrial clots, but then afterwards they should be anticoagulated. So the concept is that anyone who has AFib and getting cardioverted should be anticoagulated for at least 4 weeks after cardioversion. And if they have CHADS, if they meet the CHADS 65 algorithm, they should be anticoagulated on a long-term basis if there are no bleeding contraindications. There are some patients outlined by the CCS guidelines that if they have these conditions and they have atrial fibrillation acute, they suggest that they should hold off on cardioverting them until you have either ruled out a left atrial clot with a transesophageal echo or initiated them with OAC for at least 3 weeks. So these are patients with AFib with some other risk factors, which make them a higher risk of having a stroke. Even though it's less than 48 hours, the guidelines recommend that we should hold off. So these are patients with valvular atrial fibrillation. So anyone with a prosthetic valve or mitral stenosis will be considered to be to have valvular AF. If someone has atrial fibrillation less than 12 hours, but a recent stroke or TIA presenting with AFib, the recommendation is that we should hold off on cardioverting them unless you rule out left atrial clots with imaging, or anticoagulate them for at least 3 weeks before doing a cardioversion, assuming that, you know, the patient is stable. The third scenario is AF duration lasting 12 to 48 hours with high CHAD score, defined as any score above 2. So these are patients with, you know, some like longer than 12 hours, but less than 48, but do have multiple risk factors for stroke. In that situation, once again, you should hold off on cardioverting unless you have anticoagulated them for more than 3 weeks or have done imaging to rule out clots. And the fourth scenario is patients with AF lasting more than 48 hours. If they're not anticoagulated, there's a high chance they may have a clot, and therefore it's recommended that they should be pre-treated with OAC for 3 weeks, or once again, ruled out with imaging before you go ahead. So for all patients nowadays, you know, even though you have, let's say, 3 hours of AF and a CHADS of 0, the recommendation is that they should be anticoagulated with 4 weeks of OAC and longer if they have risk factor for stroke.
That's great. Thank you. And just to clarify for the listeners, my understanding is the valvular atrial fibrillation, as you mentioned, falls within the category of needing the oral anticoagulant for 3 weeks or more before cardioversion, but any of the other circumstances you described with those cutoffs or CHADS thresholds is in the setting of non-valvular.
Yeah. It's a good question. You know, the delineation between valvular and non-valvular is a subject of many papers and editorials in the literature. And it evolves. Typically speaking, I think in 2022, we would consider quote-unquote valvular AF as someone with mitral stenosis, moderate or severe, or the presence of a prosthetic valve. Those are the two that we would say valvular. Like, so if someone has significant mitral regurgitation native, that's not valvular AF per se. So that's kind of what we define as valvular AFib nowadays, those two categories.
Okay, that's very helpful. And in the setting where you are in meeting one of those three criteria to cardiovert upfront, you can give the oral anticoagulant as soon as possible, i.e. before the cardioversion when you're able. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. Or sometimes we would give a shot of heparin before we cardiovert, because there's some old data showing that within like 30 seconds after you restore sinus rhythm, you can already form some smoke in the left atrial appendage. So if you really feel that the patient is high risk for stroke, you can give a shot of IV heparin or even a dose of low molecular heparin. But I think IV heparin will work faster in terms of the anticoagulant effects. A bolus of heparin, then cardioverts, and then start them on an OAC an hour or two later once they wake up from the anesthetics.
That's very helpful. Great, thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about anticoagulation as it relates to the CCS guidelines. So in the CCS guidelines, we know for stroke prevention, anyone with a CHADS 2 of 1, or if they're 65 years or older, receive anticoagulation. In 2018, the patients with subclinical atrial fibrillation lasting more than 24 hours or high-risk stroke with shorter duration are treated with oral anticoagulants. Can you expand on the evolution of the scoring criteria for anticoagulation in atrial fibrillation and the evidence behind this?
Thanks. It's an excellent question, because this is one of the most often scenarios that we deal with as electrophysiologists. The reason is that we manage patients with pacemakers, and if you have an atrial lead, it's going to see, you know, assess the atrium 24/7, 365. So because of that, when we interrogate patients' devices, we often get these episodes of AFib detected by the atrial lead lasting for minutes or several hours. And it's one of the things that we always get asked about. If someone has a little bit of AFib, like a few minutes, even a few hours, you know, over a year of monitoring, do these patients need anticoagulation? I think the first hint that these patients, that this is actually clinically relevant, just even a little bit of AFib, stems from the ASSERT trial, which was done by Dr. Jeff Healy from Hamilton. So in that trial, he enrolled about 2,000 patients who have pacemakers with an atrial lead. And then he followed these patients over, you know, several years and assessed what are the outcomes for patients who develop pacemaker-detected atrial fibrillation versus not. And the bottom line is that any patients with a pacemaker-detected AFib lasting more than 6 minutes actually have an increased risk of stroke compared to those without. And in particular, when they do the subgroup analysis, patients who have, you know, continuous AFib lasting more than 24 hours detected by the device are have the highest risk of stroke compared to people with less pacemaker detected AFib versus none. So this kind of forms the basis for anticoagulating. Having said that, the definitive randomized trials showing whether anticoagulating these short subclinical episodes have not been completed. It's called the Artesia trial, also being headed by Dr. Jeff Healy. Enrollment has completed 4,000 patients. Hopefully in the next 2 to 3 years, the trial will be presented and definitely will be a high impact trial. So that trial randomized patients with pacemaker detected AFib less than 24 hours to either apixaban or aspirin in a double blind fashion. So that will give us good insight as to whether anticoagulating these shorter, you know, subclinical pacemaker detected AFib episodes would be helpful, neutral, or harmful, because there is some new data. There's something called the LOOP trial. It was published in The Lancet. It was presented in the American Heart Association late breaking trial in 2021. There's a hint that, you know, we don't necessarily have to anticoagulate people with short duration AFib episodes, even though they have risk factor for stroke. So it's an evolving field. Right now, when you look at the CCS guidelines, they do recommend anticoagulating people with risk factors for stroke, like a high CHAD score, let's say, with subclinical AF lasting more than 24 hours. But it's still, the evidence is not that strong, and hopefully in 2 to 3 years, it'll be better. So, you know, given that this is the best we have in terms of guideline, I would stick with that. You know, if someone has really high risk for stroke, let's say they presented with cardioembolic stroke, and you do see some AFib, even though it's only like an hour or 30 minutes, I think right now the clinical practice is to lean towards anticoagulating as to not, given that if there's a strong sense that AFib is responsible for some degree of arterial thromboembolism already.
That's really helpful background. Thank you. And we'll keep our eyes open for the results of that trial in the near future. Thinking a little bit about what we'll use as anticoagulation. So rather than warfarin, we're of course often prescribing our patients direct oral anticoagulants. What are some of the important trials in anticoagulation that compare warfarin to the DOACs that our listeners should know about?
Great. So as you know, right now in Canada or in the world, there are 4 clinically available direct oral anticoagulants: apixaban, edoxaban, rivaroxaban, and dabigatran. Each of them have a pivotal phase 3 randomized control trial comparing it to warfarin, and published, you know, within the past 7 to 10 years, landmark trials, published all in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they've done a lot of meta-analysis on this subject. So what we know is that as a group, these direct oral anticoagulants reduce the risk of stroke or systemic embolism by up to 20% compared to warfarin. These agents are just as safe as warfarin, because when they look at major bleeding risk, so this is substantial bleed, fatal bleeding, bleeding in which you lose more than 20 grams per liter of hemoglobin, or bleeding in which you need more than 2 units of packed red blood cell transfusions. These DOAC agents as a group have a 19% reduction in major bleeding compared to warfarin. The p-value was 0.06, which was not statistically significant, but there's a strong trend suggesting that these drugs are just as safe, if not safer, than warfarin. So because of that, guidelines around the world, including Canada, US, Europe, have systematically recommended that DOAC agents should be preferably prescribed to warfarin unless there are contraindications. The main contraindications nowadays with DOAC use are for patients with mechanical heart valves, because there was actually a trial showing that patients treated with dabigatran and DOAC had worse outcomes, more bleeding and more stroke compared to warfarin. So that's like an absolute contraindication. The other ones which are important are that we tend to not prescribe DOACs are patients of atrial fibrillation in the context of significant mitral valve stenosis due to rheumatic heart disease. That population is felt to be at a high risk of stroke, and the evidence is not there yet with respect to using DOAC for that population. The third population is patients on hemodialysis or advanced CKD, so stage 5 CKD. Anyone with a creatinine clearance less than 15 mils per minute, you know, by label in Canada, should not be given a DOAC agent. So those are the main groups.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit to talking about atrial fibrillation in the context of non-cardiac ICU illness or post-op illness. So we understand that this is not really captured in the guidelines, but have been thinking about how to manage an anticoagulation in the context of non-cardiac ICU illness or post-operative atrial fibrillation. So post-op atrial fibrillation more than 48 hours with either multiple stroke risk factors or other atrial fibrillation comorbidities may be a reason to anticoagulate. Is there evidence behind this? And what do you often see being done in practice?
Thanks. This is a very important question. And I would venture to say that this will be one of the most reasons for getting a consult as an internist. When you see post-operative atrial fibrillation or someone who developed AFib in the ICU in the context of sepsis, who have never had AFib before, and they ask you, you know, what to do. There is a strong school of thought that these AFib episodes tend to be transient, i.e. when it's a secondary type of AFib. So in the context of sepsis or post-operative inflammation, there's a belief in the community that, you know, these episodes of AF tend to be self-resolving, and that by the time the patient improves, the AFib should not recur anymore. Having said that, you know, there are no guidelines proving or disproving whether this is true. And there's no guidelines saying that you should categorically anticoagulate these people. I think you can understand why, you know, categorically anticoagulating these people may not be a wise thing in all patients, because let's say post-operative state, there's going to be a risk of bleeding. So you don't want to be anticoagulating people unnecessarily, and that hasn't been, you know, assessed with RCTs. Secondly, so that's one of the dilemma, the fact that there's a high risk of bleeding in a post-operative patient population, and also the belief that the AFib is transient. So in terms of what we do nowadays is that, you know, I think, so someone who never had AFib, developed AFib, you know, in a context of a serious illness or after non-cardiac surgery or after cardiac surgery, if there are a lot of risk factor for stroke, high, really high CHAD score, history of cardioembolic looking like stroke, you know, I think it's not unreasonable to place them on anticoagulation for several months, provided that, you know, the risk of bleeding is not high, and then reassess them in about 3 months with a Holter, extended monitoring, 14-day Holters, let's say, to see if there's any residual AF. If you do feel that the patient's risk of stroke is high, I think it's not unreasonable to keep going with anticoagulation, because there is emerging data showing that, you know, if you have AFib, it tends to come back even though it's after a major illness or after non-cardiac surgery. If on the other hand, the risk of stroke is not that high and there is a higher than expected risk of bleeding, you know, I don't think anticoagulating these people will be necessary. But it underscores the need for monitoring for these people, because they would be at risk for developing AF months, you know, down the road, and that would be treated like a regular kind of, you know, the regular kind of AFib that we see, and we have to anticoagulate as per risk factors, i.e. CHAD score.
That makes sense, and that's really helpful. And is it fair to say that, like, significant post-operative atrial fibrillation or ICU-related AFib is that might last more than 48 hours? Like, I've seen that number being used in the literature, and I'm just curious, is that the threshold which you would consider significant, or is there not? Is it not as clear cut?
Yeah, to be honest, there is no cutoff. The only guideline that made this, the timing, like a time cutoff, is the Canadian cardiovascular guidelines back, one of the older ones. They used a 72-hour as a cutoff, but to be honest, it's arbitrary. Because what if someone had three 24-hour episodes? Like, is it cumulative or it's, you know, continuous? I think generally speaking, anyone with more than 24 hours continuous AFib will be classified as significant. This is extrapolating from the previous question issue we talked about with subclinical AF, where if you have more than 24 hours, you're considered to be at a higher risk category of stroke. So this is being extrapolated perhaps in this post-operative critical illness-related ICU situation.
That's helpful. Thank you. So moving into our last question, if a patient has atrial fibrillation and they have either an acute coronary syndrome or recent percutaneous coronary intervention, How are antithrombotics and anticoagulants managed on balance of risks of bleeding and clotting and thrombosis?
Thanks. This is actually quite a complicated topic with many permutations. To be honest, if you ask 50 cardiologists, you might get 20 to 30 different methods of doing this. So I'm going to tell you what the guidelines suggest, and then I'll tell you kind of what we generally speaking cardiologists would do in actual clinical practice.
Great.
So if you have, yeah, great. If you have a patient with atrial fibrillation, with coronary disease who underwent a stent, PCI, or had an acute coronary syndrome without a PCI, this is how we would manage. So let's start with elective PCI without high-risk features for thrombotic cardiovascular events. So these are patients who have stable coronary disease, undergo elective PCI, and they don't have any high-risk features for thrombosis, like multivessel disease, multiple stents, complex PCI. So it's important to discuss with the interventional cardiologist on what the true risk of thrombosis is to get a sense. So here, communication is very key. For these patients, the recommendation from the CCS guidelines is that dual therapy with the use of clopidogrel with an oral anticoagulant for 1 to 12 months post-PCI will suffice. So you have options. You can go dual therapy just for a month, or you can extend it to 12 months, depending on the patient's risk of bleeding and also the risk of thrombotic events. After a year, then you can likely stop the clopidogrel and continue on with the oral anticoagulants if the patient meets the indications based on the CHAD65 algorithm. Let's say we're dealing with a patient who has an acute coronary syndrome and underwent PCI, or a patient who underwent elective PCI with high-risk features for thrombosis. So these are patients with multivessel disease, history of stent thrombosis, for instance. Based on the CCS guidelines, the recommendation will be triple therapy, which will consist of oral anticoagulation plus aspirin 81 milligrams plus clopidogrel from anywhere between 1 day to 1 month. So that's the recommendation by the guidelines. After 1 month, then you can stop the aspirin and go on to dual therapy with oral anticoagulants with clopidogrel up to 12 months post-PCI. And after 12 months, provided that the patient has no ischemic events, you can stop the P2Y12 inhibitor, clopidogrel, and leave the patients on OAC. And the third scenario involves patients with acute coronary syndrome who are medically managed, so no PCI. So in these patients, the CCS recommendation is dual therapy with oral anticoagulants with clopidogrel for 1 to 12 months post-ACS. And after 12 months, stop the clopidogrel and be on solo OAC. Please note that in the CCS guidelines, with respect to the choice of P2Y12 inhibitor, they only mention clopidogrel. The other two drugs, like ticagrelor and prasugrel, are less well studied and are believed to carry a bit of a higher risk bleeding rate, so it's not recommended. So that's what the guidelines say. In terms of what we actually do in practice, it's similar, but there's a bit more individualization. I would say that most patients who have atrial fibrillation and have an indication for long-term OAC undergoing PCI will likely be treated with triple therapy for a month, provided that there's no high-risk bleeding issues. And after a month, then we would stop the aspirin and leave the patient on dual therapy, OAC plus clopidogrel. In some patients with a high thrombotic risk, you know, operators would suggest that they be treated with ticagrelor early on and perhaps step down to clopidogrel after a few months. After 12 months, you know, it's quite usual practice for people to stop all the antiplatelets and only leave the patients on oral anticoagulants for AFib stroke prevention purposes.
That's great. Thank you. And just to confirm sort of for our listeners, this is in patients who have an indication for oral anticoagulant, i.e. their age is 65 or above, or yes, have a CHADS of one or more. Otherwise, you know, we'd be looking at a different algorithm, assuming their CHADS was zero.
Yeah. Yeah. So if they don't have AFib, then the OAC is not part of the equation. They'll be treated with the dual antiplatelet therapy.
Right.
And that's a different set of guidelines.
Right. And then if they have AFib, but their age is 42 or their CHADS is zero, then we wouldn't be thinking about the oral anticoagulant.
Yep.
We would just be thinking about the thing. Yeah.
So these are patients who have AFib and have indication for long-term oral anticoagulation. So age more than 65 or CHADS one or greater, according to the CCS guidelines.
Perfect. Thank you.
No, thanks for the opportunity to allow me to speak.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to our listeners about this important topic and a high yield one for Royal College and other exams. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode on the CCS-CHRS Comprehensive Guidelines for the Management of Atrial Fibrillation released in 2020. Special thanks to Dr. Andrew Ha for joining us today to discuss these guidelines.
This episode was recorded and produced by Shaliza Halani. The Internist Guide 2 podcast series is produced by Catherine Luer and Shaliza Halani. Executive producers Allison Lai, Zara Morali, and Leia Kirianopoulos. Theme song by Lakshman Vasanthamohan.
Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again soon.